Welcome to the Leadership School Podcast. I'm your host, leadership and self-care coach, Kyla Kofer. Here at the Leadership School, you'll hear leaders from around the world sharing their stories and expertise on how to lead with balance and integrity. Our goal? Teach you how to be an extraordinary leader. Welcome back, leaders. I am pleased to introduce to you today, Rob Patterson. Rob is a former CEO of a major hotel brand in the UK. He's now a motivational speaker and executive coach. He's written a book called Flip and Decide with Confidence. So he tells us a little bit about his book, but really what we talk about is decision making. So he has a really unique method of making decision, and that's just as simple as flipping a coin. So he's going to walk us through a little bit about what does it look like to make decisions in trying times. And he talks us a lot about how he made a really big decision for his hotel during COVID and how that affected thousands and thousands of people in a really positive way. So thanks so much for listening and tuning in. And please welcome Rob Patterson. Rob, thanks for coming on. And why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us about you and what brought you here, a little bit about your journey. And then what we'll do is we'll just ask you, I've got like a ton of questions for you.
Well, in a previous life, I used to be a CEO of a large hotel chain that most people would know of in Great Britain. But I think you reflect in moments like COVID and think, you know, what's life all about and what am I here for? And I think I had this epiphany one day that I'd kind of lived my uncle's life, and it sort of started at a really young age. I was always compared to my uncle. You look like him and you play sport like him and you're very entrepreneurial minded like him. And you know, you kind of just hear that from as long as I can remember, probably the ages five or six, as far back as I can remember. And that becomes your story and your life. And it kind of became my story. He was very successful in business and he went into politics later on in life. And I kind of followed that business path as well. And then I got to the top and sort of thought, well, hang on, this isn't everything I thought it was going to be. And so each role that I progressed, I thought, you know, something's going to change. And next one's going to be the one I'm going to feel fulfilled. And I got to the CEO role and I just didn't feel that. So it was COVID that forced the reflection. And I talked with my chairman of the company at that time. And we set out a plan, a 6-month plan to transition. And I left the UK and I moved to the US and wrote a book and started fresh. And here I am now. I'm early in that journey. I'm about 18 months into the full journey. It took me a long time to get the visa, but here I am.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot to unpack there. So you felt like for most of your life, you're kind of living in your uncle's story, like somebody else's story. You were just following along kind of a path that you thought was kind of pre-carved out for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and I think a lot of people fall into that trap, right? It's very easy to, people have expectations on you. I don't know if anyone had the expectation that I had to be like him, but I just constantly had it reinforced, you know, started with my grandmother and my parents and then everyone in the family, wow, you look like him. And, you know, he's a wonderful guy. I really like him, but he's not me.
Well, they also had a lot of pride in his accomplishments. And so the pride that you saw other people having in his accomplishments, you might have wanted some of that pride in you and your accomplishments. So it made sense to kind of follow in those paths. And then, so you did, and then found out like this really wasn't who you were and what you wanted.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of blessed in one way because, you know, we could have been told I was like, I don't have a bad uncle, but if there was a bad uncle, you could have been said, you're like this person. And you can start to understand how people end up sort of emulating people, the role models around them and the people around them. So luckily I had a good positive role model there.
So you ended up as the CEO of a large hotel chain in the UK. Are you from the UK?
From Australia originally. So and hospitality took me all over the world and ended up in the UK. My grandmother was born there, so it was easy for me to get a visa.
So you've kind of been all over, Australian born, lived in the UK, and now you're in the US. You've just spent a lot of time in a lot of different places kind of developing and growing and all over the world.
Yeah, I would say right now I am kind of trying to figure out my place in the world and doing it in a place where nobody knows me and you're starting from scratch. And that's a lot of fun, but it also comes with a lot of challenges as well.
Yeah. What made you decide the US? You left your job as a CEO, and I want to talk a little bit about your job as a CEO, but I'm really interested in this story because moving to another country is no small task. And you moved to the US and you didn't know a soul here.
Yeah. I lost all my business contacts. I had a handful of contacts in the industry here but not like I had in the UK. And it always looked up. Growing up in Australia, and I tell this to a lot of my friends here in the US now, growing up in Australia, we kind of looked up to the US, you know. It was, for me, I was growing up in the 80s and the 90s, and there was like Carl Lewis and there was, you know, Michael Jordan, and sports plays a big role in Australian lifestyle. And we just looked up to the US, all the artists, like the musical artists. And it's just one of those places that you kind of aspire to live. And I think most people in the town where I came from don't leave the town where I came from. I was like, yeah, someday I'm going to go there, you know. And I knew I'd end up here at some stage or another. I just didn't realize how difficult it might be to get here.
Interesting. So you kind of had that mindset or visualization of always having this plan out here, and then you decided to make that happen. Tell me about making that decision, because that just to me is a really courageous decision to say, I don't know anybody. I'm starting over. I'm leaving my job. I have no finances, no resources, and I'm going to pack up and move to another country. Was it just like this? It was just the time and you had to do it. And I mean, it was not an easy task. So tell me about making that decision and how you made that decision and then how you handled all the hurdles through it.
How it did start was, yeah, I just wasn't satisfied in the role that I was in. There's a great book by an Australian nurse called Bronnie Ware, and she worked in palliative care, and she tracked the top five regrets of the dying. I think that's the name of the book, actually. And one of them was that the top one is that you live a life that's true to yourself and not true to somebody else. And I could sense that I wasn't really happy in the role, and things were starting to find them niggly and annoying, and it just wasn't right for me. You know, I was successful and I did well at it, but it wasn't fulfilling. It wasn't my purpose. So I was kind of like, well, I need to find what's my purpose. So I had initially planned to take 6 months, and I had budgeted to take 6 months to up from the UK and move to the US and settle and find a job. And that was my plan, was to come over and find something else and work. And I must have applied for hundreds of jobs, and I literally had one interview. It was really tough. It didn't matter my background or my profile in the UK. It was all counted for nothing. It's very humbling in some senses. I went from CEO to ZERO, I say, CEO to zero.
Wow.
And then 6 months down the line, I'm like, hey, I'm nowhere further than where I was 6 months ago, except for my bank balance is nowhere near where it was 6 months ago. So
I bet.
So that was sort of the first major period of inflection to say, well, I need to really sit back and decide, what am I going to do? And that kind of caused me to go down the route of entrepreneurialism. It was something that sort of always sat in the back of my mind and what I wanted to do. And it forced me to, I guess, humble myself a little bit and decide to start again. That was really where the big change happened for me.
Wow. So you've had to make a lot of decisions. You had to make a lot of decisions in making that leap across the pond and made a lot of decisions into starting entrepreneurial and a lot of decisions on how to just go about your next steps. But that's not the first time you've had to make decisions. You've made a lot, I mean, leading up to a CEO role. You don't get to a CEO role without making a lot of decisions. And this is the topic of your book, is about making some decisions. So tell me a little bit about your decision-making process, because it's very unique.
Yeah, so it started back in high school, actually. And I don't know if you have the same here in the US, but in around 10th grade, when you're about 15, In Australia, you get to choose the classes that you finish your school with. They're called electives. And I was kind of sitting down looking at the list going, I'm 15 years old. I just love playing sport. I don't really have a clue what I want to do beyond that. So I was like, well, how am I going to do this? And I did play sport, and I played at a pretty high level. And on the sporting field, you know, we were coached to act on instinct and to never second guess, just to go for it. And if it doesn't work out, at least we learn something. But if you hesitate, you screw the play upfield and you really damage the side by hesitation. So, but I didn't have that same system in life. And I was like, well, what am I going to do? And actually, I was pretty, I guess I was so focused on sport, it didn't really, wasn't a high priority for me. So I took a coin and I flipped it, and I chose my classes that way, my electives that way. And it sort of stuck with me for the rest of my career and rest of my life. Was like, hey, this is a great way to decide. I never thought about it again. I literally flipped my coin, took the class, and didn't look back. And I gave everything to the class. And actually, that class happened to be what's called home economics. And that sort of set the path for my hospitality career, ironically. So maybe it was right or wrong. Wow. I don't know. But
so you put your future in the hands of a coin.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So your coin flip in high school led you to home ec, and that ended up leading you into the career of hospitality where you ended up as a CEO. You don't know that when you were 15 and flipping that coin. So tell me about this process of flipping a coin. Like, when I hear flipping a coin, I mean, I have my own stories of when I've done similar types of things. And I've also used to tell people to do that, to flip a coin, because if you're not sure which way to go, pick A or B. I used to do it with like movies, right? What movie should we watch? I don't know. Like, let's flip a coin. And when you flip, you'll always know which one it is. Because if you flip tails and then you're like, actually, I don't really want that. I want the other one. You know what you're going to do either way. But you don't really take that approach. You say you have to commit to whatever you decide or whatever the coin flips. And so I'm just really curious about this process, because for me, it was kind of always a laid back thing, but you've really taken it seriously and have used this. That seems a little bit scary to take like a CEO role or a high position of leadership role and say, well, I'm going to make a decision by flipping a coin.
It does sound quite flippant and a little bit irresponsible, but it's much more complicated than that, and it's much more detailed than that. The flipping of a coin for me only comes in where I'm torn between two options. And at that point, once you've gone through a logical process in your mind of, these are the pros and cons on either side, and whatever your process is for conscious decision making, and you can't find reach an outcome, you're pretty much torn between perhaps two options or three options it might be. That's the moment that I pull out a coin and say, you know what, let's flip a coin. And I think it did change the course of the company that I was working for in the past when COVID came about. And there's a story right at the start of COVID. I was sitting at home on a Sunday morning. There's a very powerful political show every Sunday morning, hosted by Andrew Marr and a guy called Andrew Marr. And I was watching the program, and the health minister was on TV talking about, well, how are you going to deal with the situation when the beds run out at hospitals? And I had an absolutely genius communications director, and he messaged me on the Sunday morning and said, hey, I've got this idea. Why don't we throw all our bedrooms out to the government to turn them into hospitals? And that's a pretty big decision, right, to go on national television, the biggest political show of the week, and say, hey, you can have all of our bedrooms. You know, we're talking 20,000 bedrooms across the UK. And typically, wow, that's a decision that would go to the board, and it would be a discussed at the boardroom level before it was made. And there was no time for that, right? It was a very unique circumstance for everyone. And literally, I sat at home and I was like, wow, this didn't. Okay, I can see the pros of this and I can see the cons of this. Staff could be concerned if they think we're opening hotels and there's no protection for them from COVID. There was all sorts of things, but actually I couldn't reach a decision. And it was a split second. So I took a coin, I flipped it, and we decided to run with it. And within about 30 minutes, we were on every national press outlet in the country offering our rooms. In fact, it went around the world offering our rooms to be turned into hospitals. And about 2.5 weeks later, we actually opened our first hotel as a hospital to transfer non-critical patients to. So it changed the course of COVID for our entire company on the flip of a coin.
Wow. So the flip of coin from the CEO turned a hotel into a hospital.
Several.
Wow. How did that play out? Was it really effective? And was it really helpful? I mean, did you fill up the rooms, the beds? Like, tell me how those logistics played out.
It was really quite incredible the way the community came together around it. We weren't quite sure how the local community would take it, because they might say, hey, we don't want COVID patients coming into our area. But actually, the local community got behind it. And, you know, it was a time when altruism was strong. You know, people really wanted to help the country out and help. In the UK, it was the NHS. That's how we tried to position it. We want to be at the front. When things mattered, we wanted to be there to help. And that's how we positioned it, and that's how it was received in the media. And it was, and we got a lot of support from government as well, because typically, I mean, to change a hotel to a hospital, you have to do a lot of things, jump through a lot of hoops. And first one is planning. So you've got to repurpose the building legally to be able to be a hospital. And that would typically take months, even years. And we had help from politicians, and that was done in the space of 2 weeks, just completely unheard of. We needed things like fire regulations are completely different for a hospital than they are for a hotel, and we needed all this equipment. Well, local schools came together for us, local businesses brought around things that we needed that we didn't have to make it fire compliant. Then we had things like we had to store medicines. There was all these things that were completely uncomfortable to us and way out of our reach normally, that all happened in the space of 2 weeks. And it was actually when the first ambulance brought patient to the hotel, all the local neighborhood lined the streets and had signs for them, no welcome, get well soon. They had an opera singer come and sing outside the hotel to the, these were recovering patients. They weren't actually patients who were at the peak of COVID. It was about freeing up beds. So it was a phenomenal project to be a part of, and just to see the community come together was amazing.
That's incredible. And did you end up with just one hotel turning into a hospital, or did you have multiple hotels?
Yeah, multiple. There were several up and down the country. But we also became the go-to sort of brand for not just hospitals, but of course, during that time, there was people who needed housing, whether they had, maybe their house caught fire, emergency accommodation, maybe they were homeless for some reason or another, domestic violence, abuse victims, all sorts of things like that ended up staying in our hotels, even asylum seekers. So it sort of set the course for the entire crisis. And actually, we came out of that crisis. You don't ever want to go through a crisis, but it was what I'd say was a good crisis for us.
Sure. And how did your board feel about you making that decision so quickly on the fly? What was their reaction when you told them you made it with the flip of a coin?
I wrote about it in my book. So they know now. But
after the fact, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission sometimes.
That was the theory. It was like, you know what, let's, because normally it was quite a laborious process to make decisions in that company. And for good reason, I'm not criticizing it. That was the culture of the company. So it came as a shock, I think, at first. But I was already there for a good 3 years and they sort of understood how I operated. So the surprise was still there, but I think they kind of knew my style. So.
They didn't have time to be surprised. Yeah. There was work to be done, right?
Exactly. And, yeah. And it played out so well that there was no ill feelings towards the end of it.
So I started this podcast because I wanted to learn and grow in my leadership journey. And I have been so incredibly inspired by the guests and the conversations. So once the interview ends, I actually keep the conversation going because I have found that sometimes the richest part of the conversation is when we feel like the interview's over and we can just kind of have a relaxed, more casual conversation. Also, if you've noticed, if you've been following this podcast for some time, I used to ask every guest 2 questions. What does integrity mean to them? And what does balance look like to them? Well, I haven't stopped asking those questions. We're just putting those over on our Patreon page. So go check it out at patreon.com/leadershipschool. And for $6.50 a month, you can support this podcast. It takes a lot to produce every single episode. And honestly, I could use a little bit of support. So anything that you're able to contribute would really mean a lot to me and would be able to help me to continue to bring these high caliber guests in to have conversations on what does it look like to be an extraordinary leader and how do we practically do that. So those conversations are continuing over at patreon.com/leadershipschool, where I'm asking guests some extra questions, some bonus questions, and you'll get some bonus content over there. So be sure to go check it out. Thanks so much for your support. And thanks so much for subscribing, listening, and sharing this podcast. It really does mean a lot. And I'm so honored to show up here in your podcast feed. So let's break this coin flipping thing down a little bit, because like you said, we don't want to treat it like it's flippant, but it is. You talk about in your book how there's some psychological reasoning behind it, and it actually can be a sincere method of making a difficult decision. And you said just a minute ago, you've narrowed down the choices, you've already done the research, and you've got a few choices in front of you. So is it a point where you realize that really either one of these decisions would be fine? I mean, in this case, this was a pretty big decision, but thinking about some other decisions that might be along the way when you've really done the work and the research and everything, you've come down and really it could just be either of these decisions would be fine. And we just have to pick one and go and see where it takes us.
And that's one of the golden rules of the process, the method, is that when you flip that coin, you've got to be committed to the one that comes out and really go for it. And you can actually make a wrong decision right by really committing to it 100% and gathering momentum. There's a thing called the rule of declining motivation. And what that rule says is that the longer you wait to do something, the less likely you are to do it. And that flip of the coin is like a form of metacognition. and it stops your limbic system, your fight or flight system, from taking hold and telling you all the reasons why you shouldn't do it. So when you think about, you know, I wrote a book and I could have thought about all the reasons why not to write a book. If I'd left it and said, oh, I might write a book one day. Oh, yeah, but no one will read it. And how would you do this? And how would you do that? And you've never done that. And all the reasons not to write a book, but you kind of just act on it straight away. And that's what the flip of a coin kind of does in the brain, is it stops your limbic system in its tracks from preventing you from doing something. And then once you get started, you gather momentum, you have small successes along the way, and your confidence builds and it carries from there. So that's the basis of the flip of the coin.
So tell me about this, though, making a wrong decision right, because that's the first thing you said. You can always make a wrong decision right. So walk me through that. What if you flip the coin and you're like, well, that was definitely the wrong way to go?
There is a point where, and I talk about this in the book, there is a point where you do need to let go of a bad decision and walk away. But there are situations where the brain comprehends information that it's available to it at that time, and then things change. And I think about buying a house, right? If you'd have bought a house just before the crisis, perhaps in Florida or somewhere like that, southern or sunny state, that decision at that time might have been a 50-50 decision. But then, of course, when COVID hit, that became a really great decision, right? Because the prices of houses went up really, really quickly. And that's that moving data point can sometimes make your decision wrong in the past. So in that case, it makes it right, but it can sometimes make it wrong. And the information you have at that time might be 50-50, but then the next day, new information comes available and you think, actually, I've gone with an idea that was 50-50 yesterday and today it's 40-60. But at that point, you're not looking back. You've made your decision, you've started your work on it, and you've got momentum, and you just keep going. And that can happen, you know, in everyday decisions. You might think about your takeaway situation and say, well, am I going to have Thai or am I going to have pizza? And then you turn up to the pizza place and there's a 1 hour wait for just to get served. So that decision is looking less likely. So, you know, those moving pieces means that the odds can change in your decision. But if you live your life constantly looking in the mirror and thinking, well, hey, did I make the right one? Did I make the wrong one? You're not actually taking action against that decision. You're not moving forward and you're not creating momentum. So even sometimes you can have a decision where it might turn out that it was a lesser percentage decision. Actually, you make it work because you've got momentum, you've got focus. And that's what a flip the coin does, is you commit to that decision 100%.
So it's really just taking the pressure out of the decision to understand that it's just a decision, that it's not taking you one way or the other. It's not destroying or making your life. You can do something with the result regardless. You know, most of us don't make big decisions every day, right? We're making little decisions like, do I make my bed today? Do I eat cereal or eggs for breakfast? You know, you're making these little decisions all day long and you don't really think about it. But then we do come along these big ones and that we feel a lot of pressure with them. My decision's going to affect a lot of people and I'm going to really struggle through this, or this could really make or break me. And it feels like this might be the end in this moment, right? This might be the end of my life as I know it. And maybe some of those decisions are, if you work in the emergency room or in some of these places where some of these decisions really, really are critical. But what you're saying is, when you've done the research, you've put all the pieces together and you're faced with a few decisions that really you just have to make one and go with it. And by flipping a coin, you're kind of giving the power to the coin, right? You're giving the power to the coin to say, it's like you're pulling your tarot cards or whatever. I'm giving this power to the coin. I'm just going to go with it. I'm going to commit to it. We're going to make this decision and go. If you're really feeling stuck, like this is a little tactic, a little tool for when those moments you're really feeling stuck and you're just need some support making the leap, like taking that step forward.
That's exactly what it is. And we make 35,000 decisions a day is what research suggests. So by the way, I didn't know any of this before I wrote the book. I researched this both through reading, but also interviewing neuroscientists and psychologists. And I had no idea we make up to 35,000 decisions per day. So actually the majority of the decisions are made subconsciously. And that's really where the book focuses is, yes, there's the flip of the coin when you come to a split decision, but we also got to really focus on those subconscious decisions that we make, the ones that we make just autonomously, and whether to brush your teeth, whether to make your bed, things like that. And there's a foundation that you need that is really critical from a physiological neuroscience perspective and from a psychological perspective to make sure that they are as accurate as possible and that you move in the right direction. So that's a big focus of the book, is the flip of the coin. It's great and it's a form of metacognition and it's It's really good for committing to a decision when you're uncertain about a big decision, but it's also focusing on those other probably 34,950 decisions that you make every day that are subconscious.
Wow. You don't think about them. I mean, I just thought about my husband peeked his head around the corner, didn't realize I was in a call, and I just ignored him completely. And like, that's a decision, right? I didn't really have to think about it because I'm still in the middle of this conversation. I ignored him completely. And now he's probably going to be wondering what I'm doing, you know, and he'll figure it out. And it's just these little decisions that I didn't have to flip a coin for that. I just was able to make a decision. But I'm thinking a little bit more about, do I buy this house or do I not buy this house? You do the research and with the information that the best information you have in front of you. And sometimes ultimately you just have to pick.
Yes.
You just have to pick and go. And there is the psychology behind that, that we tend to just get so afraid of sometimes ourselves. We don't have that confidence and security when the stakes are high because we don't want to mess up. We have that fear of it going badly.
Yeah. And that's the fight or flight system kicking in, right? It's designed to protect you from changing circumstances. So when you ever think about, hey, I'm going to change something in my life, I'm going to start a new career, or I'm going to buy a new house, or I'm going to buy a new car, those big decisions that you make in life, or I'm going to commit to this relationship, or I'm, heaven forbid, this relationship isn't right for me, whatever it is, those big decisions, that's when the fight or flight system really takes over. And it's fear at the end of the day that's driving it. So that flip of a coin, once you have sat down and logically gone through it, and I'm not suggesting you just put it all to chance. Once you've gone through that process and you're kind of down to the few, that is a fantastic form of metacognition that can really bypass and get you through the fear.
Wow. Yeah. Awesome. So Rob, you've got tons of experience. You've written this great book. Tell us, what are some other pieces of advice that you might have for somebody who is looking to really grow in their leadership experiences? Because we've talked so far about, you know, knowing yourself, knowing your own purpose, and not following in the footsteps of somebody else just because you think that's your path, but also being willing to make decisions when the stakes are high. What else would you think would be really valuable for people to know as they're growing?
I mean, I'll bring it back to decisions, but a great leader will be defined by the decisions they make or they don't make. In the book, I talk about six dimensions of what I call the mental scales and how you'd make decisions every day, and whether that's how you work with the person that's really difficult to work with, direct report, whether that's managing up to a board that's challenging, whatever it might be, it's the decisions that we make. And these mental scales, there are three foundational mental scales, and then there are three maintenance mental scales. And they're pretty, probably unsurprising, but it's incredible how many people today. I do executive coaching, and one of the first things that I do with when I'm doing executive coaching is define values and you know, what the purpose is in life, or what somebody's purpose in life. And it's incredible how a few people really, if you say to them, what are your values, how many could sit there and just say, these are my values, second nature. And that's the process that really, one of the foundational tools of any leader, that just sets the sails for all your decision making. It's the compass for your ship. If you're running a business, it's a compass to your business. It's also the compass for your staff, because if your staff are confronted with a situation and say, these are the values of the organization, well, does this behavior align to the values of the organization and your values? And that helps you with your decision making, both subconscious and conscious. So number one is values. And that's probably the highest priority on for any leader, is to really define what their individual values are. And the second part of that is, does that align to the company that I'm working for? And that doesn't just apply to leaders, that applies to anyone. You set your values, does that align to the company that you're working for? Because if you've got a renegade company that you're working for, and perhaps their environmental thing is one of your values, and they're out there tearing up the oceans, you're probably not going to be engaged and committed and loving your job. You know, you're not going to really enjoy that job. So values is the number one foundational thing to focus on for decision-making and for leadership.
Well, I think it sounds to me like your values were in line a little bit more than you realized when you made that decision to bring the hotel chains into hospitals, because you that did affect a lot of people, and you had staff that you had to care for and who now were running a hospital and had to rearrange and make thousands of decisions, and people had to support that, and the value system really would have come into play in that role.
And it certainly did. Thinking about that decision, it could have backfired, and it could have been that people, customers might say, well, hey, this hotel chain has had COVID patients in their hotel. I'm never going to their hotel brand. So it could have majorly backfired on us. So there was a lot at stake with this decision. And fortunately, it didn't. The community got behind it. And we were lucky that we read the room. But the question there was, when I sat on the couch, that I was literally sitting on my couch at home. I sat on the couch there that day. One of the first things I said is, what's the right thing to do here? What commercial impact this could have in the future? What's the right thing to do in this situation? And it was a really dire situation. You know, all of the hotel company staff were sitting at home, not sure where the next paycheck was going to come from. So not sure if they were going to get sick or their family was going to get sick. It was a global crisis, as everyone knows. So that really played a big part of, am I going to go for this or not going to go for this? Let's flip a coin, because if it lands on that, I'm 100% committed because it's the right thing to do. So values did play a big role in that.
Wow. Okay, so what was the second thing? First thing was the values, and then the second thing.
The second thing really plays to wish I knew this many, many years ago is what's your purpose? What's your meaning in life? And I think there's no great, probably no silver bullet defining your purpose, but I think a parent might define finding their purpose as raising their children and keeping them safe and protecting them. And what is it that will get you out of bed and will drive you to do something when the chips are down, or even when your own safety or your own credibility or future or whatever it might be is at jeopardy? What is it that will drive you to do that? And that's the second one of the foundational dimensions. And then the third one is having goals. And I know that sounds very cliched, but for a company, it's KPIs, it's or OKRs or whatever format you use in your company. It's having a clear set of goals and then tracking those goals regularly and getting moving towards them, taking steps towards them. The three maintenance dimensions are unsurprising. I think a lot of people finish school and then sort of that's it. I'm done for schooling. You know, I'm in my working life and we stop learning. And education learning is the fourth one. This is really, really important for intuition. And I tell this story a little bit because since I moved to the US, we develop in our brains what's called heuristics, and we develop, they're like mental shortcuts, right? So they help us make quick decisions without thinking. And what they are is neural pathways in the brain. And I've developed one, which is that when you approach an intersection, the short corner, so here in the US, it's the right-hand turn, the short corner I associate with left. So whenever we're coming up to an intersection and I'm in the passenger seat directing, I always look at the short corner and I say, I'll turn left here. And the person starts going to cross the traffic. And I'm like, hang on, no, not that way. Because my brain has developed a neural pathway that makes that association, makes that connection. So those heuristics is what they're called, is the technical term. But those shortcuts can let you down in a big way. So education is the way to continually stay on top of changing circumstances, and they're particularly dangerous in changing circumstances. You can think about things like the Titanic sinking and airplane accidents. All of these come down to mental shortcuts that we've taken that we think are the right time, but in a crisis have led to the wrong decision. So heuristics and constantly updating your education and your process and continuous learning is something that we all should do for the rest of our lives and never stop. But it's interesting how we leave school and kind of think, well, that's it. My schooling days are behind me. But I think Mark Twain said that he never let school get in the way of his education. So the education is number four.
Right. Always be growing and learning and not leave it behind at any point. This is 2023. Technology is multiplying by the time you wake up in the morning. So you've got to keep learning and growing, or you'll just be in the dust, left behind, not being able to keep up with anything. And everything's constantly shifting and changing, no matter what industry you're in. Everything is growing and shift. Everybody's always looking for better ways to do things and learning from mistakes and learning from past bad decisions. And so we need to keep up with that to keep our own minds sharp and fresh and be able to continue to make better decisions the next day, you know, and not regretting the ones that we made yesterday. Because we made yesterday's decisions with the best information we had yesterday, but taking that and making the best decision today and tomorrow, making better ones.
Yeah, absolutely. The fifth one is your environment. And this is, again, kind of come as no surprise. The people you choose to hang out with are pretty much, I had a mentor at one stage in my career who said, show me your friends and I'll show you your character. And that's 100% true. So there's a whole chapter on that in my book I won't go into now. And the last one is trauma. And that's a really big one for any leader or any decision maker. The company that I joined in the previously, where I was a CEO, had gone through a lot of tough times, and their whole processes and structure was set up around things going wrong. And that held them back in a lot of ways. And it's the same. The story I use in the book is about a dog bite. You know, if you've met anyone who has been traumatized by a dog at a young age, they're unreasonably nervous and uncomfortable around dogs. And actually that serves against you when you later on in life, if you've been bitten by a dog as a young child, and then you come across a dog and immediately you start exhibiting fear, the dog picks up on that fear. And it can then cause further problems. So going back and dealing with past traumas, and I write about some of my own personal traumas in the book, you will have fundamental flaws in your decision-making and fundamental flaws in your leadership without dealing with trauma. So that's the six dimensions of the mental scales for decision-making and for leaders, for that matter.
You know, it's really working on yourself constantly in every area, like breaking it down and always taking that step back. And, you know, there's several themes for any listeners to this podcast of any time, length of time. The themes that we get into, if you haven't figured out at this point, are emotional intelligence, personal development of the leader, that leaders have to be continually working on themselves and building up their own emotional intelligence in order to be successful. So this has been really valuable, Rob. Thank you. I just want to see if there's anything. What's the name of your book? Did we get that? What's the name of your book?
Yeah, it's Flip and Decide with Confidence. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the good stores, good bookstores.
Awesome. And that's going to be a link to that, I believe, should be in our show notes. But Rob, this has been really a pleasure talking with you. And is there anything else you want to make sure that our listeners hear before we head out?
No, that's it. That's been a pleasure to chat with you. And thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is great. Hey, thank you so much for listening. If you've liked what you heard and you want some more tools and resources to help you on your journey, go check out kylakofer.com/free-stuff.